Russia doesn't publish stats on how many soldiers have died in the war on Ukraine, so journalists have come up with a number, about 70,000.
So the 70,000 people, all of them, we know by name and we verified each name.
And that's likely a very conservative estimate. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. In Germany, there's a new political party standing in state elections.
It's not something we've seen a lot in Europe. It kind of forms this, what's now been called left conservative.
Plus, we already have Swiftonomics. Now we need a word for the economic impact of baseball player Shohei Ohtani.
He is doing something that we haven't seen any baseball player in 100 years do. And maybe even longer than that.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has been deadly for Ukrainians, but tens of thousands of Russians have also died fighting in that war. The Russian government does not reveal those casualty numbers.
But the BBC and the independent Russian media organization Mediazona have conducted a painstaking count of their own, and they've settled on a concrete, if conservative, number, 70,112. Mika Golubovsky is a journalist for Mediazona who worked on the count. We reached him today in Vilnius, Lithuania. I asked Mika how they arrived at that number.
So the 70,000 people, all of them, we know by name and we verified each name with multiple sources. The actual death toll on the Russian side, of soldiers on the Russian side, is much higher. We are totally aware of that. And we even have some estimates, but it's approximately two times the number of the soldiers we know by name.
Mm. So you think that, so you've been able to verify about 70,000 fallen soldiers. You think it might be actually about 140,000. Why is that? Who is missing in this count?
Well, since, you know, Russian authorities don't like to talk about casualties, it's pretty hard to get the data. What we do get, mostly we get from social media and some databases of the government, which are open, and sometimes visits of volunteers to cemeteries. But, you know, not all people get an obituary on social media. Not all graves could be seen by volunteers, so we know from data of the probate registry, which we use to kind of come up with an overall estimate. So we take the probate registry, which has data on people who leave inheritance, and we look at excess male mortality in these numbers, compare it with our names list, and that gives us, you know, it's some pretty complicated math that the most likely, as of June of this year, it was 120,000. So our next estimate should be within maybe a month or two, and it should be about two times the name count.
Mm. Why doesn't the Russian government publish these figures? I mean, is it a matter of morale, or, you know, or not telegraphing to the opponents just how high casualty figures are, a combination of both?
You know, if they emphasize the actual death toll, a lot of people in Russia, I think, would, you know, be thinking, what does this war mean for them, for their loved ones, and what risks does it imply, even for them personally?
I mean, there's no numbers that are being published, but do you think it is really quite opaque to the Russian public just how many people are dying?
Well, the overall number, of course, yes, it is unfortunately opaque. They need this, you know, images of war heroes on the one hand. On the other hand, if you collect all this data, it sums up to an astonishing number, you know, much higher than any of the wars that Russia or the Soviet Union fought since World War II.
Mm. I noticed that the kinds of people dying has changed over the course of the war, according to your data. At first, it was largely contract soldiers, but in recent months, it's been a lot of volunteers. What does this tell us about the progression of the war?
Well, yeah, when the invasion just launched, you know, the Russian authorities and the Ministry of Defense, they just thought that they would, a bunch of specialized troops like airborne or Marines would be enough to storm, take Kiev in 3 days or whatever, which was not the case, right? So then the regular army started to fight, and we saw a lot of casualties in contract professional soldiers. Then we saw a lot of casualties of mobilized soldiers, because in September of 2022, Putin announced a so-called partial mobilization. And a parallel process was inmates recruited by mostly Wagner PMC. Then the process of inmate recruitment was sort of transferred to the Ministry of Defense. So the Russian government officially now hires, you know, killers and rapists to fight its war. But the Ministry of Defense apparently is not as effective as Wagner was, at least in destroying, you know, their own troops.
Mm-hmm.
In the recent, like, I don't know, maybe year or so, probably since the assault on Avdiivka, we've seen more and more volunteers, which are basically people who, you know, for various reasons, mostly financial, as we think, join the army. They're not mobilized, but they are, you know, tempted, or, you know, they just need the money to survive. And so that's the kind of volunteers that are dying.
So you are doing this work like so many Russian journalists in exile, so that you can do this work. Why is this important enough for you to be in exile? And I imagine any future prospect of returning home is very much murky at this point. Why is this important enough work to flee?
Well, because, you know, it's really important to, for me at least, to record what's happening. For those who do understand the gravity of the situation, it's support. And if we can change some people's opinions, that would be just, you know, probably the highest result we could hope for.
Mika Golubovsky is a journalist for Mediazona. He spoke with us from Vilnius, Lithuania.
We've got an update now on the conflict in the Middle East. The Israeli military claimed responsibility for an airstrike in Beirut today that killed a senior official from Hezbollah, Ibrahim Akil. He'd been accused by the U.S. of being involved in the 1983 attacks at the American Embassy and the U.S. Marine Barracks in Beirut.
Israel's military said that Akil was killed alongside other senior operatives of Hezbollah. According to Lebanese officials, the strike destroyed two apartment buildings, killed at least 12 people, and injured many more.
Over the last 24 hours, Hezbollah fired dozens of rockets from Lebanon at northern Israel, and the Israeli military said it bombed about 100 launching sites for Hezbollah rockets.
President Joe Biden said today that his administration is still working toward a comprehensive ceasefire deal so that thousands of people in southern Lebanon and northern Israel can return to their homes safely.
And we will continue to follow this story as it develops.
Circuses have stood the test of time, but one legendary act is in danger of extinction, at least in Europe, the human cannonball. You know, the person who climbs inside a cannon to be shot into the sky. It is a showstopper, usually saved for the big final number, but in Spain, that won't be true for long, because there is just one human cannonball left in the country. The world's Jerry Hutton went to see him at the circus in Llavarnés in northern Spain.
Human cannonballs usually have flashy names like Zazel, Lulu, or the Flying Zucchini Brothers. Then, there's Kevin.
Mi nombre es Kevin de la Torre.
My name is Kevin de la Torre, he tells me on a recent night. Stage name, wait for it.
Kevin Dola.
Kevin Dola. Kinda ordinary, but the circus Kevin works in, the Coliseo, is itself modest. No lion tamers or trapezes here. Mainly, it's just dancers and clowns juggling and joking around. Kevin's clearly the draw. When I catch up with him between shows under the Coliseo's big tent, he's dressed in a red, white, and blue jumpsuit, helmet in hand. On the other side of the ring, in the shadows, sits his 25-foot-long cannon.
6 años llevo siendo hombre bala. Ahora mismo 29.
I've been a human cannonball for 6 years now, he says, and I'm 29. In Spain, he tells me, I'm the last one. In all of Europe, there are just three of us. I will carry on, he says, but the profession is clearly on the verge of disappearing. Why, I ask, just before the gates open and spectators fill the bleachers? Because, he tells me, you climb inside a cannon.
And here's yet another picture of the human cannonball.
As did the Zucchini brothers in 1938 in this show in Atlantic City, they ended up in Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. But this tradition is a lot older. The first human cannon dates back to 1871 in England. It was invented by the Great Farini, or Canadian William Leonard Hunt. Almost more amazing than the contraption itself, that Farini convinced a 17-year-old, Rosa Richter, to get in it. Richter, known as Zazel, was shot up to a trapeze bar, unscathed. Ringling Brothers snatched her up, too.
Hombre, el peligro está siempre, eso está claro. No sabes si va a aguantar la red.
Kevin says the danger's always there. You don't know if the landing net will hold or what shape you'll be in when you land, and that's assuming the cannon doesn't misfire, he says. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Fire!
But accidents do happen all the time. In 2011, in Kent, England, performer Matt Cranch died when his landing net collapsed while he was in mid-flight. He's one of an estimated 30 cannonballs who paid the highest price for their acrobatics. A quick aside here, which you can find on YouTube, human cannonballs are not really being shot. They're catapulted off a hidden platform using high-tension springs. The bang and flash spectator sees is just for show. That said, you still have a lot of calculations to carry out before you can safely catapult a human at 60 miles an hour, 150 feet through the air, onto a net.
Very much like a rocket launch, you have all of those physics that are involved.
Bruce Hawley is president of the Circus Historical Society in the U.S. I asked Hawley how the early pioneers fine-tuned a human cannonball's trajectory without losing any humans along the way.
They would practice with a dummy that weighed exactly the same weight as the human that was going to be fired. And, of course, that's where it gets tricky.
Because there could be wind, if it's an outdoor event, he says, or rain. Hawley tells the story of Elvin Bell, winner of a prestigious Golden Clown Award, given out yearly like the Oscars but for circus stars. Before each show, Bell's team would calibrate his cannon with the official Bell dummy, but one day the dummy was left out in the rain and got heavier with water, so the trigger guy got the cannon angle wrong.
He overshot the bag or the net, and he ended up being paralyzed. He's recently nominated to go into the Circus Ring of Fame.
Bell, that is, not the trigger guy. Hawley says it isn't just danger driving human cannonballs away. He says the act, like most circus acts, tends to stay in a single family, like the Zucchini brothers. The knowledge, the tricks, it all gets passed on from generation to generation until it doesn't.
Certainly, there are families where the kids don't want to do it, and they move on. And it's the end of the line, so to speak.
Kevin, back at the Coliseo Circus here in Spain, is not from a cannonball clan.
Y lo mío fue algo raro, porque al final yo, a ver, mis padres son los dueños del Circo Coliseo, pero...
My case is odd, he says. My parents own the circus, but the cannonball family we have, the Taylors, they adopted me, as it were. It isn't often that a family bequeaths a tradition to an outsider, he says, that they teach you the secrets of their craft. But Luis Taylor, the last cannonball in the family, was retiring. Against all odds, he passed the tradition on to Kevin. As the Coliseo show nears the end, Kevin appears atop the long barrel of his Swiss-made 1954 cannon. He lowers himself inside.
3, 2, 1, 0.
There's the flash and the boom, and a split second later, there's Kevin, soaring through the air, arms out front like a superhero. He crosses the main ring, tucks into a mid-air roll, lands perfectly on his back, on a net that does not collapse. The crowd cheers wildly. Kevin takes his bows. As of yet, he has no protege, but he's young, single. With a little luck, he'll find someone, have little cannonballs, and keep the tradition flying. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Llavaneras, Spain.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. One of the driving forces behind tech regulation worldwide is Margrethe Vestager. She's a Danish politician who for the past decade has been in charge of overseeing EU business regulations. And one of the hallmarks of her leadership has been taking on big tech, like Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. She does this on behalf of the European Union's 27 member nations. Vistea is here in the U.S. for meetings at the UN as well as with the Biden administration, and we caught up with her in our Boston studio this morning. Now, you've been called the world's most famous regulator for taking on the tech giants, doing things like holding Apple accountable for $14 billion in back taxes. Tell us what happened in this case. What were you able to accomplish?
Well, you know, most businesses, they just work really hard to make a profit. And from that profit, they pay their taxes. And they are faced with competitors who do not, to the same degree, contribute to societies where they do their business. And societies need taxes, also from companies for infrastructure, for education, for health systems. Because of that, we have been looking into if some member states in the European Union have been too accommodating for certain companies, and Apple being one of them, enabling them to transfer profits to a stateless so-called head office that had no offices, no desk, no chairs, no nothing, but also no taxes to be paid. And we have lost cases and we have won cases and we won this one, which means that Apple will have to pay 14.8 billion euros to the Irish taxman.
Now, you've had similar success regulating Google recently. What was the outcome of that case?
So our competition cases, they are not about you cannot be big. They're about your behavior. Because you can be big and successful in Europe, you're more than welcome, but you cannot misuse your market power. What we found in this Google case was that Google had misused its market power to promote itself, to show people products by Google Shopping and demoting others who would do the same service and maybe even better.
I see. So Google won't just present you with Google shopping opportunities.
Exactly. That is the point, because as consumers, we should have choice from different services. And here we were proven right by the court. The difficulty in that kind of cases is, of course, that they take a long time.
Now, your office was pivotal in the writing and enforcement of an EU antitrust law called the Digital Markets Act. In the simplest terms, explain what that law does.
So the Digital Markets Act makes the market open, contestable, which means that consumers have more choice. And if consumers have more choice, then it becomes more interesting to invest in businesses providing that choice. So it's a piece of legislation that will give you a new market dynamic for consumers to have choice and for businesses to have a better chance to get to you. And because of that, a better chance of getting investors on board.
And how does that differ from how things operate in the US?
Well, this piece of legislation doesn't exist anywhere else on this planet. The mechanisms of the legislation is that if you have a certain size, we will designate you as a gatekeeper. And then you get these obligations. You cannot promote yourself. You need to enable others on your services. You need to share data. You cannot just keep them to yourself. And that doesn't exist anywhere else. It's really important. It will go hand in hand with the specific competition law enforcement and specific cases. But it allows us to be much, much faster in finding anti-competitive behavior.
I'm speaking with Margrethe Vestager, the Executive Vice President of the European Commission. The regulation of social media companies in particular seems to be a big priority for the European Union. Why is that?
I find it to be 100% legitimate that in a democracy you decide what is illegal. Excitement to terrorism, sharing of bomb recipes, abusing children. And we have seen that online it is not always treated as illegal. Also in many member states, hate speech is illegal. But when online, not treated as illegal. So the Digital Services Act will for everybody put in place a system so that if something illegal is taken down, you will be noticed, you can complain about it, and you can take that to court.
I want to talk about the rules governing the use of artificial intelligence. The European Union and the U.S. have taken really different approaches so far, and some might say the U.S. lags behind. Can you lay out the differences for our listeners to explain the sort of philosophical underpinnings of how the EU has been approaching this versus the U.S.?
Well, actually, when it comes to AI, we have kind of the same approach, realizing that you cannot regulate technology in itself. Because our democracies, compared to the technological development, they are slow. So if you wanted to regulate technology, it might be outdated, your piece of legislation, within the next 3 months or 6 months or something. So we have decided to have the same approach to look at the use cases. Now, in the European Union, we've been able to legislate. That has not happened here in the US. And our legislation is completely sort of hands-off when it comes to innovation and research. It's very light touch when it's, customer service bots or whatever that may be. It is only sort of really demanding on you if you use artificial intelligence where people might be harmed.
What's an example?
Well, it could be sort of if a public sector entity is using artificial intelligence to figure out who should have a child benefit. Well, then you need to know that this AI doesn't discriminate. It can be if you use AI in Europe, if you call 112, the equivalent of 911 here, you can use artificial intelligence to hear what is the problem with this person. That's part of it was better to find symptoms of a heart attack in a man than in a woman. Not good. You really need your algorithm to work in a way that it doesn't distinguish based upon gender to figure out should I send an ambulance or not.
What's your biggest lingering concern with AI?
So, you know, I hope that if we get it right, that the individual is protected from sort of existential risks of being discriminated, being faced with societal biases now ingrained in the algorithm. If we get that right, the risk for humanity as such may be smaller. But I think it's really important to follow very closely how the different AI systems, how they work. I think one needs to keep very close attention in order for this to develop in a positive manner for humankind.
I'm just curious. My final question is, you know, you've been at this a long time, and did you feel like you were kind of crying in the wind for a while? I mean, did you have to bring people along with you? I mean, you've had strong views about, you know, regulating tech for a long time. Did you have to find some momentum for your views?
I think when I sort of picked up the first Google case, shortly after that, I was here and it was like, what is that crazy woman doing? Because we were first movers on this. But that has changed dramatically, both because of the scandal, think of Cambridge Analytica with Facebook, because of the behavior in Australia, where they had, you know, a straightforward ask for media to be remunerated for journalistic work. So little by little, things have changed. And now many people have a much more nuanced view on technology, and I think a much stronger ambition to be hands-on to prevent the downsides. Because the risk, of course, if you have a laissez-faire approach and you don't want to do anything, then the huge majority of us, we end up as just meat for the machine. And the wealth that is being created is just for the selected few.
Margrethe Vestager is the Executive Vice President of the European Commission. You're listening to The World.
The deadly assault of a doctor in India has sparked national outrage about violence against women. But some note that the issue only makes headlines in certain cases.
A person from a certain class, from the city, a doctor, it needs to hit somewhere that, oh my God, if it's happening to them also, then we are not safe.
That's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Japanese MLB player Shohei Ohtani keeps swinging and sliding to baseball history. Yesterday, he hit his 50th home run of the season for the LA Dodgers.
On a 1-2, Ohtani sends one in the air. The other way! Back it goes! Go!
That's on top of 50 stolen bases. Feels historic, right? Here's what the Japanese broadcast sounded like. Ohtani is obviously an incredible athlete on the field, but he's having an economic impact off the field, too. Victor Matheson is a professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. So, Victor, let's talk about the appeal of Shohei Ohtani. What makes him a marketable athlete and public figure?
Well, the main thing is that he is doing something that we haven't seen any baseball player in 100 years do, and maybe even longer than that. Here's a guy who can pitch with the best pitchers in the league, who is leading the league as a hitter. And this year, because he's injured and he can't pitch, decided, well, he's just going to go out and steal bases. Again, doing things that no one thinks is imaginable.
Ohtani signed a $700 million deal with the LA Dodgers. Do you think he's been worth that money so far?
So far, it looks like an awfully good deal. When we look at every metric of how he's performing, not at the plate, but at the box office, he's doing spectacular. The Dodgers are leading the league in attendance by a long way. They might get almost 4 million fans through the gates this year. The Dodgers are leading the league in road attendance as well. So it's not just his home fans that want to see him. Everyone wants to see this phenom.
Wow. Now, he's had an economic impact in the U.S. and Asia. Let's start in Asia. What's his economic impact been there so far?
Well, he's wildly popular in Japan as well. So, for example, he played in the 2023 World Baseball Classic, which Japan won, beat the United States in the final game, with Ohtani striking out the great American Mike Trout on the very last play of the series. Each one of those Japanese games being broadcast in Japan were among the most watched sporting events the entire year in Japan. They're gaining Super Bowl-like ratings for each of their appearances there. So it's not that he's just popular here in the United States. He is wildly popular in his home country as well.
I'm wondering, do Japanese travel to the U.S. to watch Ohtani play?
The answer is yes. I mean, we know it happens. And it also did happen for sure when the first great Japanese baseball star came across, and that's, of course, Ichiro. We also know that the presence of a really strong Japanese player also allows that team to sell their media rights in Japan for top dollar. So back originally when Ichiro was playing for Seattle, Seattle had one of the best TV deals and highest TV revenue in the major leagues, as high as the Yankees. But it's not because they were selling TV rights to the local Washington area. It's because of the TV rights they were able to sell to Japan.
How much has he done in terms of bringing more international attention to Major League Baseball itself? I mean, surely the league is benefiting from his playing here.
Yeah, they certainly are. One of the things that baseball, however, faces is the fact that it is very much a regional rather than world sport. So, for example, Ohtani is the most followed baseball player on Instagram. He's got about 8 million followers. Just as a point, that's more than the second, third, fourth, and fifth most popular baseball players in the world all put together. That being said, 8 million is a fraction of what dominant players in world sports like soccer attract. Both Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi have over 500 million followers. So anything baseball can do to expand its footprint, and here we have the best player in the game by far, certainly doing something to do that.
And how about in the U.S.? Has this economic impact been a big deal for Los Angeles?
Maybe not for Los Angeles in particular, but certainly for the league as a whole. We have seen overall attendance in Major League Baseball rebound very strongly since the pandemic. And after about a decade of slide into the pandemic, things have actually picked up a little bit. And we've seen attendances not quite to the record levels that we saw in the early 2000s, but not far off from that.
So do you expect this Ohtani effect to continue to grow? I mean, especially if he continues to break records.
We certainly would expect that to happen. But of course, the key with any sport is, can players stay healthy? Again, he broke all sorts of records last year by being a spectacular hitter and pitcher, the first real dominant pitcher and hitter combination since Babe Ruth 100 years ago. But he was injured, and now is only hitting and stealing bases. So every baseball fan is hoping the best of health for Shohei, because he is just a pleasure to watch.
Economist Victor Matheson joined us from the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts.
This week, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger announced they would be rolling out a common passport. This comes a year after the three nations announced their plan to withdraw from a bloc of 18 countries known as ECOWAS. That's the Economic Community of West African States. The common passport is the latest step in a growing alliance among these three countries, all led by military juntas. And it's causing alarm for neighboring states. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has the story.
They call themselves the Alliance of Sahel States, and last September, the military leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger signed a mutual defense pact. This week, they further solidified that alliance when they announced the common passport.
Chère population de la Confédération des États du Sahel,
Mali's military leader, Colonel Sima Goïta, who's the acting president of the Alliance of Sahel States, delivered the news on national TV. He said the passports would be available in the coming days. But Kamisa Kamara is skeptical. She was Mali's foreign minister and chief of staff to the former president, who was overthrown in a military coup in 2020.
Since the creation of the Alliance of Sahelian States, we've only heard announcements. Announcements that there is this new organization, an announcement that the three countries are breaking away from the ECOWAS. This breakup is not official yet, and they can retract. They can just say, no, we've changed our mind, right? Now they're announcing a new passport. They've announced a currency. We've only heard announcements so far.
She also says they don't have the money or resources for the rollout. Nevertheless, the announcement signals the strengthening of the breakaway bloc. In January, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso declared their immediate withdrawal from ECOWAS. They said it was because the African body is under the sway of France and other former colonial powers, which is a powerful and familiar message in this region of the world. Here's an English translation of Burkina Faso's military leader, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, speaking at the first summit of the Alliance of Sahel States in July.
Africa is a continent that has suffered and continues to suffer due to imperialists. These imperialists have but one cliche in their head. Africa is an empire of slaves. That's how they view Africa. For them, Africans belong to them. Our land belongs to them. They've never been able to change their ways.
But some observers say the anti-colonial rhetoric is a smokescreen.
Soldiers guard the residence of Mali's president Ibrahim Boubacar Keita in the capital, Bamako.
In 2020, Mali's military overthrew the civilian government and seized power. There was another coup in 2021 that was followed by a coup in Burkina Faso in 2022. When Niger's military followed suit in 2023, ECOWAS imposed sanctions and demanded elections. It even threatened to intervene militarily and restore the ousted president, Mohamed Bazoum. That's when the three countries ditched the West African bloc. Elizabeth Shackelford is a former U.S. diplomat who served extensively in Africa. She says the real reason Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso quit ECOWAS was to escape pressure to return to democracy.
ECOWAS leadership and the ECOWAS countries made clear that they expected these countries' military leaders to shift towards a timeline to return to democratic civilian role. And none of these countries wanted to do so.
The coup leaders, once they were in power, wasted no time in kicking out French and American troops who were there to help fight terrorism. The Sahel is now the global epicenter of terrorism, according to the UN. To fill the vacuum, the juntas turned to Moscow and the Wagner Group. Shackelford says the Russian mercenaries are purportedly fighting jihadists in the Sahel, but mostly they're propping up military regimes.
Russian involvement in a lot of these countries has proven not to stabilize or improve security, but to do the opposite. So I do expect that we'll continue seeing, as long as Russia is the partner of choice in these places, you're going to see worse human rights records, and you're going to see ongoing and worsening stability.
And that seems to be what's happening. This week, the Malian capital, Bamako, was attacked by a terrorist group linked to Al-Qaeda. Gunfire erupted near the airport as jihadis attacked a military police training camp. Kamisa Kamara, the former Malian official, says extremist violence has surged across the Sahel this year, contradicting claims by the juntas that the security situation is under control.
It is getting really bad. And those who are able to flee the country have done so.
Kamara says African leaders and policymakers are struggling with how to respond to the military leaders in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. Sanctions haven't worked, she says. Isolation hasn't worked. For its part, ECOWAS is shifting strategies. It has lifted sanctions, and in August, ECOWAS defense chiefs, led by Nigeria's Christopher Musa, urged Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger to return to the bloc.
So we're extending olive branch to those countries. I want them to understand that we are not enemies.
The olive branch is still hanging out there. The three Sahel strongmen have said their divorce from the rest of West Africa is final, as they continue to grip tightly to power. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
And now, some recent news you might have missed.
a man in Spain with a brain tumor worried that having it removed would rob him of his chess-playing prowess. Well, he asked a surgeon there to leave what part of the brain he needed for chess intact. So a medical team jolted the man's brain with electricity. It's called electrical stimulation, while he was awake. They then asked him questions to determine the parts of the brain he used to dominate the chessboard. A new report in the journal Cortex says this technique dates back to the 19th century, and it was apparently a success. Checkmate.
A baby pygmy hippo in Chonburi, Thailand, has become a viral sensation online. In real life, legions of fans have been making the two-hour drive from Bangkok to see little Mudang. Her name translates to bouncy pork, a type of Thai meatball. She's famous for playing in puddles and opening her jaw wide so it looks like she's screaming, not clear whether in joy or horror. Mudang's fame is raising awareness and money, apparently, for the conservation of her rare species.
And a giant baby penguin is rocketing to fame in Australia. The 49-pound feather ball weighs more than both of his parents combined. According to the Sea Life Melbourne Aquarium, more than 1.9 billion people have viewed baby Pesto on social media.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
Germans in the state of Brandenburg head to the polls this weekend. The far-right Alternative for Germany Party, or AfD, is expected to top the statewide election, as it did in the state of Thuringia earlier this month. But there's another anti-establishment party competing, and despite just being 8 months old, it could change the course of German politics. Rebecca Collard reports from Potsdam, just outside Berlin.
Herr Lauterbach, der da heute immer noch als Minister rumspringt. Ich finde ja schon skandalös.
In a square in central Potsdam, Sarah Wagenknecht, the leader of Germany's newest political party player, lists the party's recent successes.
Wir hatten die Europawahl, das BSW hat mit über 6%
First came the European Parliament elections. We got 6%. Then came elections in Thuringia and Saxony. We entered the parliament with double digits, she tells the crowd. That shows you we can make a difference and we can change something in this country because so many people want change. Founded just in January after Wagenknecht split from Die Linke or the Left Party, in 8 months her party, Bundesserie Wagenknecht, or BSW, has managed to attract voters not just from her old political party, but from established parties almost across the political spectrum. In a fiery half-hour speech, Wagenknecht touches on things like health care and education, but focuses on issues that have dominated state elections, immigration and the war in Ukraine. Issues the state has little control over, but that voters like Uwe Bertelot say are top election issues. First of all, the question of war. She has a very clear position for peace and peace negotiations. And that makes them different from other political parties, he says.
So the BSW is an incredibly unique party in the German party landscape, and it's not something we've seen a lot in Europe. So it kind of forms this what's now been called left conservative.
Sarah Wagner studies the movement at Queen's University Belfast.
This fast prominence and this fast appeal is completely unprecedented.
That unprecedented appeal is turning BSW into a political kingmaker. The more established German political parties have vowed not to partner with the AfD, the German far-right party that recently took a third of the votes in local elections. And so without Wagenknecht's party, it would be nearly impossible for those parties to form majority coalitions.
Gerade mit dabei, eine schlechte zu basteln.
Nein, das werden wir auch nicht machen. Ich meine, die Wahlen sind ja ein Aufschrei der Menschen, ein Schrei nach Veränderung.
In an interview just days after the last state elections, Wagenknecht repeated that for her party to join any coalition, even at the state level, it would require other parties to make substantial changes to their foreign policies on Ukraine.
Viele Menschen sagen, die Bundesregierung sollte sich viel mehr um Diplomatie bemühen.
Many people feel the government should try much harder in diplomacy rather than relying on sending weapons, she told the host. Wagenknecht has been so vocal about her opposition to military support for Ukraine that her critics have accused her of being a mouthpiece for Moscow. Others have accused the BSW of having policies that are aligned with the AFD, like wanting to restrict immigration and not wanting to send weapons to Ukraine. But Vega Connect has worked hard to differentiate her party from the far right and has ruled out forming a coalition with them. She dismisses allegations that she is somehow connected to Russia. Vega Connect is not a candidate in state elections, but it's her face that graces almost all the campaign posters.
And she is seen as representative of defending the interests of the working class, the poor, and the people living and working under precarious conditions.
Heinz Birbaum is with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, a think tank connected to the left party that Vega Connect quit.
In the public opinion, it's still seen as a left-wing party. In my opinion, it's not a left-wing party. It's a very populist party, and the point of reference of this party is certainly Sarah Wagenknecht, because she is well-known.
While BSW's fast rise has shifted the German political discourse, Birbaum says he doesn't think Vega Connect will be able to drastically change national policies yet. But Germany will have federal elections next year, and if BSW continues its rapid ascent, it could pose a real challenge to Germany's weakened ruling coalition. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Potsdam.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This next story is about violence against women and may not be appropriate for all listeners. In India, a national reckoning about women's safety is underway after a female doctor was raped and murdered there last month. It's not the first case of a high-profile assault prompting widespread discussion in India. Sushmita Pathak reports from Delhi on the complex questions surrounding violence toward women, including what's often missing from that conversation.
In the early hours of August 9th, a junior doctor in the city of Kolkata in eastern India retreated to a seminar hall of her hospital. She wanted to get some rest after a long shift, but she never woke up.
There's some breaking news coming in. Junior doctor raped and murdered at Kolkata hospital.
The news sent a tsunami of anger through the country. Indians flooded the streets to demand justice. When Mallika Taneja, a theatre artist, went to a protest in Delhi, she was reminded of another protest 12 years ago, for Nirbhaya. That's the pseudonym given to the woman who was gang-raped on a bus in Delhi in 2012.
And a whole bunch of us who had been there during the Nirbhaya protest were standing there and thinking, how are we here again 12 years later? We are here again.
For many in India, the 2012 case was a rude awakening about violence against women. Now, Indians are feeling frustrated, like nothing has changed. There's an epidemic of sexual violence in India, says Mona Sinha, Global Executive Director at Equality Now. There are 86 rapes recorded per day on average.
And these are only reported cases, so I'm sure that there are many, many more that go unreported for a variety of reasons.
While it may feel like there's been no progress, Sinha says India's laws have become stronger. After the Delhi case, India set up fast-track courts to expedite rape trials. It broadened the definition of rape and banned a degrading rape test. But implementation is the challenge, Sinha says.
We've heard from survivors and activists about instances where officials and officers actually fail to record or investigate reported crimes. They coerce survivors into dropping their complaints. There's a strong push to compromise. And especially when a family member is involved, I mean, you can imagine how high the pressure is.
Rapes by family members or people known to the survivor made up 96% of all rape cases in 2022. Domestic violence is rampant. Marital rape is not even a crime in India. Many victims of sexual violence are poor women in rural areas from marginalized communities. But their stories rarely spark protests, notes Mallika Taneja, the theatre artist.
Perhaps it always should be a person from a certain class, from the city, a doctor, you know, like it needs to hit somewhere in a way that, oh my God, if it's happening to them also, then we are not safe.
Cases of urban educated women attacked by strangers in public places get the most attention. It creates a narrative that women are not safe outside their homes and need to be protected. As a result, women's freedom is curtailed. Hostels put night curfews for adult women, but none for men. And families tell girls not to roam the streets at night.
We shall fight, we shall win.
In the days following the Kolkata rape, women across India took part in a protest to, quote, reclaim the night. We are claiming our right, we are claiming our night, they chanted in Delhi. In 2016, in response to the Delhi rape case, Taneja started Women Walk at Midnight, bringing together groups of women to explore their city at night.
We are practicing to be more courageous about the night. We are making the city practice looking at us and normalizing our presence. Why should the night belong to only the men and the street lamps and the dogs and the traffics and not to us?
Empowering women and strengthening laws goes a long way. But it is not enough. To root out sexual violence, Sinha of Equality Now says we need to focus on chipping away at patriarchal attitudes.
It's the fear among men of losing control that is at the heart of violence, and that needs to shift.
Engaging men and young boys is crucial, says Harish Sadani. His nonprofit, Men Against Violence and Abuse, trains men to be more gender sensitive. He says society teaches men to see women a certain way.
She's somebody's sister, daughter, you know, but never an independent person. So either you see women as a secondary being or as a sex object.
Sadani's work involves helping men unlearn these patriarchal notions. He says heinous crimes like rape don't occur in a vacuum.
They are as a part of continuum of gender-based violence. So, you know, somebody is not born a rapist.
It happens after years of normalizing seemingly harmless sexist behavior, Sadani says. Small day-to-day things like sexist jokes or misogynist swear words all contribute to rape culture. Tackling those can be a good first step toward becoming more gender-sensitive, he says. Meanwhile, more than a month after the Kolkata doctor's rape, an investigation is still going on. A civic police volunteer has emerged as the prime suspect. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Delhi.
It's probably true around the world that the best way to expand your musical horizons is to tune in to what other people have on heavy rotation. A friend or a partner or a relative. That's how it happened for Ugandan singer-songwriter John Mook. He was visiting family in Kampala when he came upon this song in his cousin's CD collection.
That's right, We Are the World, a charity single released in 1985 by some of the biggest names in music. When John Mook discovered the song years later, it changed his life. Mook was a budding musician at the time in Mutungu, Uganda. He played bugle. But this song was Mook's first exposure to Western pop music. It inspired him to learn English and write his own songs. He also ditched the bugle and picked up the guitar.
Mook then got a gig on a popular cruise line, and that got him a visa to work in the U.S. He moved to Austin, Texas.
And then his music caught the ear of record producer Dan Auerbach, who joined forces with Mook on his debut album, Flying Away, which came out earlier this year.
I always dreamed I'd go away. Some maybe I could fly. So I left my home and I was 23 years old and sailed away into the night.
Now, John Mook is on the road performing around the U.S. Amazing how life-changing a cousin's CD collection can be. We close with John Mook's autobiographical tune, Flying Away From Home.
Sometimes you have to search before you find me. The light can seem so very far away.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here on Monday.